I'll be. A hitchhiker in an Easter Bunny costume. Hop in. Where are you headed?
BJ's Wholesale Club to do my Easter shopping. I have so many baskets to fill.
That costume is so lifelike. There's not even a zipper.
Oh, there's BJ's. I can hop out here.
Look at him go.
Get a $15 digital coupon when you spend $150 on practically anything in one transaction through April 20th. Coupon will appear in your digital gallery on April 24th. Terms apply. Go to BJ's.com/Easter coupon for details. BJ's. Absurdly simple savings.
Mark Marquez dominates again and Jorge Martin suffers a yet another horrifying injury. Welcome back to Tank Slappers. I am your friendly neighborhood host, Trey Harrison. Glad you could join us to talk all things MotoGP post Qatar. I very nearly said Bahrain. Now you see I've still got F1 on the mind there for a second. Some bike fans are going to kill me for that, but able to differentiate between the two, well done me. But yes, welcome to Tag Slappers. Glad you could join us. And a very newsworthy Qatar Grand Prix. A lot to talk about on and off the track. Marc Marquez's third double victory of the season. A Maverick Vinales podium, or so we thought, and Jorge Martin very sadly back in the hospital, and some not very pleasant scenes as a result of that. But to break it all down with me, I've got a couple of heavyweight journos with us. First up, making his Tank Slappers debut, Mr. Richard Asher. Hello, Rich. How's it going?
Hey, great to be here on debut. Lovely to be with you guys.
Yes, big thanks to Ben for suggesting Rich to come over, and you've probably seen him on Autosport and Motorsport.com without even realizing, because he's been doing a lot of great work there covering MotoGP over on those sites for us. And of course, I have to say, and I'm giving him a little round of applause here on the other side for his tremendous interview with Mr. Marc Marquez this past week in Qatar. Well done, Mr. Yuri Pujamon. Congratulations, sir. Over 30,000 views on YouTube since then. Well done, sir. Brilliant job on the interview. How was it out there?
Was good. Thank you very much. Was good. Was easy. I mean, Mark always makes things easy. I mean, not only on track, but also off track.
No, shout out to Yuri. Did a fantastic job covering that. Shout out to Ben Holmes on our video team as well, who flew out there to help cover everything. Did a really, really good job, and we're very proud of it. If you haven't checked out the full interview, we've got the full audio version on this very feed. Go back and listen to that. Or if you feel like you want to see the video version, you can on the motorsport.com YouTube channel. We do recommend it. It's a pretty good watch, if we do say so ourselves. But Mark continued his fine form off the track, on the track, with another victory, his third double win of the year, wins this in the sprint, wins in the Grand Prix over Pecco Bagnaia in second, even though Pecco was third on the road. We'll get into a little bit more detail about that later. But Yuri, once again, once Mark gets it going, virtually unstoppable. But he did have a little bit of early teething problems. Not the smoothest of starts for Mark this time around, was it?
Yeah, it was. I would say a bit of a tricky start for him, especially on Sunday. But I'm a bit concerned about how the things are gonna develop during the season, because after what we've seen in Qatar, I think that Mark he's in a position to win most or all the races. In those, he doesn't make a mistake. I mean, if he does not make a mistake, his performance shows that he's in a position to win most of them. So I think Pecco is in some kind of problems here, and all the others, I mean, they are not under as much as pressure as Pecco. But yeah, that's why I say that we can have a bit of a, let's say, monotonous, does it exist in English, championship. So let's see. Hopefully, Pecco will hit back and will give us some kind of, let's see with KTM, but yeah, I mean, what we've seen so far is that Mark is in another dimension.
It's hard to argue with that, really. I mean, Rich, this was, I don't know how much you've been listening to the show, but something we've been talking about a lot on this show was this was kind of meant to be the key round for Bagnaia, the round where he might find some form again and actually be able to challenge Mark, because the early start of the season really favoured him. You know, you've got Argentina, a track he's gone very well at before. Cota, okay, he made a mistake, but he was clearly dominating that race before the crash. Thailand as well, another track he's gone around well and won at before multiple times. So we kind of knew early on that Marquez was going to be strong, maybe not this strong. Qatar was meant to be the Pecco comeback trail, and well, he's just been beaten by 4.5 seconds, Rich. This is you could argue this is maybe panic stations. Yeah. If you're in the Man United camp, I mean, if you're Pecco, you've got to be very nervous now about the rest of this season, given that this was meant to be like the redemption round, and he's just been soundly beaten. He had a Horlicks of a weekend.
Yeah, no worries, Dre. I've been a loyal listener to the show always, of course.
Good man.
But yes, exactly what you said, really, and what Yuri said about how monotonous it could get up at the front, particularly given that we have such a ridiculously long championship. I mean, if you had, like in the old days, another 10 or 12 races to go, you could imagine surviving that. But it's a lot more monotony now when we have another 22 minus 4. That's 18. It's a vast number of races, and there's two every weekend. It's going to be hard to tell stories for all of those if it's just a Marquez show at the front all the time. And as you say, it was absolutely – this was the one we were all clinging to with some hope. And I think Mark saw that, and he didn't mind sort of playing up to that before the weekend and saying – and kind of agreeing with everybody, this is my weak circuit. I don't know how much he really believed that, but you know, if he lost, then his prediction was just coming true. And if he won, it was obviously going to be incredibly demoralizing for the opposition. And hey ho, he won.
First Qatar win for Mark in 11 years. This was meant to be one of Mark's weaker tracks. He, as Richard said, quite rightly, he said to the media, this is one of his weaker circuits on paper. He doesn't particularly like it here. Bagnaia has won here multiple times before. He won here last year to kick off the 2024 season. And just not ideal on that one. But yeah, this was on paper one of Mark's weaker rounds. And yeah, completely dominated. Once he got to the front, nothing could touch him. It's that back half of the race, Yuri, that I think Mark is just strongest, where, you know, we've seen his brother Alex arguably lead as many laps as he had all season, and before this weekend, where Alex was a little bit weaker. But just that back half of the race pace seems to be where Mark is just completely unstoppable at the moment. Fastest lap of the race was on lap 16.
Yeah. I think that in my opinion, the things that should others scare the most is that he's in total control. I mean, not only the fastest, but the kind of domination. I mean, he puts a plan in place. He did it in Thailand when he had this pressure, this tire pressure problems, and also in Argentina, when his brother overtook him. And also here in Austin, he was going to win until he got, let's say, he said that it was not aggressive enough. He made that mistake and he crashed, but he was 2 seconds clean on the lead. And here, again, we had a different kind of a scenario, and he put a plan in place and easy. He won the way he wanted. So that's the most impressive thing, and at the same time the thing that might scare the most to the others, because we haven't seen this kind of domination of perfection from him, because we were used to have this Mark smashing all the others, just pure speed. Here we have, let's say, a 2.0 version of him, and it's even more efficient.
12 straight 152s to close out that race right at the end. Then he dipped back into the 53s in the final lap when he was coasting over the line. Yeah, terrifying pace.
He knew that this front tire had only 10 laps. And he saw Morbidelli going through, and he said, okay, he will come back. And in the end, he did. Morbidelli was super fast, but he was overcooking the tires. So, and Mark had that in mind. So that's what I say, and that's what I mean. I mean, he has a really plan, and he puts perfectly in place.
Yeah, just on that version 2.0, it's becoming more and more clear that Mark is not just the fastest and maybe the most talented rider, but we're starting to see that he is also the most experienced. As we wrote in Autosport during the week, you know, that he is the only guy surviving from his debut race in Qatar in 2013. So it's all the other things he's got going for him, he has now got a wealth of experience as well. And when it comes to those tire management races, he's just drawing on all of that and doing it perfectly.
It's a terrifying thought, given that Marc Marquez is the same age as me, and he's now the most experienced man in this field. It makes me feel every bit of my 32 years. I'm not going to lie to you, gentlemen, but here we are. No, it is one of the things. I mean, going back to Bernard for a second here, Rich, Haref's really might be the last chance, because we've got Haref next weekend. He's won the last three Spanish Grand Prix in a row, a couple against Quartararo, narrowly beat Marquez over the line here last year. If Mark wins in Jerez as well, do we just cancel Christmas from now and just call it a day and we all go home? Is that the feeling? Because, I mean, for me, that's kind of where I'm looking at the calendar and I'm going, Pecco hasn't got very many super strong rounds left, and that's a problem.
Yeah, I think after Qatar, the idea that there are such things as strong Pecco rounds is kind of starting to look like real optimism and clutching at straws. I think Pecco can possibly clutch at one straw, which was the battle that he had with Mark last year at Jerez and beating him wheel to wheel. But of course, when he thinks about it, he's going to realize Mark was on an older bike then and still getting used to life at Ducati. So that is not much of a straw to clutch at, unfortunately.
The 23 is definitely not the 24 or 25 that we've seen dominate this championship so far this year, and, you know, bring out the best in Alex Marquez we've seen for most of this season so far. And again, Mark has just been untouchable on this, I guess you might want to call it hybrid spec GP25, you know, a combination of parts from the 24 and this year's off-season development, however you want to describe it. It's certainly working in the hands of Mark, that's for damn sure. As three wins out of four sprint wins out of four. The only person so far that's beaten Marc Marquez this season has been himself, which I guess has always been a Marc Marquez problem.
Four pole positions out of four.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's the Cota drop is the only thing that stopped him from perfection, which is just terrifying to even think about. Speaking of terrifying things, unfortunately, the other major story coming out of this race was the reigning world champion, Jorge Martin, who this was his first race weekend back after dealing with multiple off-season injuries. One, obviously, the first one being off the Sepang test, and then the training accident, which broke the scapuloid bone in his wrist. This was his first weekend back. He was going pretty well. I mean, it was an extended test session, really, for Martin all weekend, just to get the feeling back and get some race sharpness going. He finished the sprint in 16th place, which was, again, I think still an achievement in of itself. Was hovering around that sort of range again during the race itself. And for those who... Yeah, I warn you now, this is not going to be very nice detail, so you might want to skip a couple of minutes here. He had he crashed over the backside of the curb in that turn 10, 11, 12 complex, that series of right-handers, the elevated curbs which Formula One put in for their Qatar Grand Prix. And as he's in the middle of sliding on the ground after the crash, he's hit by Fabio Di Giantonio, collapses his lung, 11 broken ribs, as we've come to know since then. It was taken to Hamad General Hospital since then. But Yuri, just horrible to witness in real time, of course. And you're probably thinking the worst at that point in time. We know how bike racing goes. What's the latest on his condition, and and just how is he more than anything else?
Well, he's getting slightly better, but of course the problem is that we are in a era where the motorcycle racing is getting more and more safe. But the problem is this kind of crash is the worst possible scenario in a motor racing. I mean, being stuck in the middle of the track and being, let's say, vulnerable for somebody who comes from behind hitting you. He was lucky. It could have been much worse. It could have been much worse. So, he was lucky because it could have been much worse, but also because of all the protections that we have nowadays in place. Bad luck, but good luck at the same time. So, what else can I say? It was heartbreaking. It was, we were completely shocked. Not as at the beginning, we didn't realize that it was going to be that bad because he was moving on track, and that's the first thing that you check on when you have this kind of crash. He was moving all the time, so I say, okay, he's not that bad. But then you realize when you put the slow motion and then you see that the hit with Dija, you say, whoa, what's going on? Then you read about the pneumothorax and the stuff. And of course, we got the last update about the 11 broken ribs, that he's going to stay in the hospital for a few days and we won't probably have him back for a while. I'm not going to say when, but I would say that it will be around a couple of months minimum.
I was going to say, it's one of those things that it almost feels crude to talk about when's he going to come back, when my first thought was, my God, he's lucky to still be alive. Because you're absolutely right, Yuri. When I was watching that in real time, you don't realize it all happens so fast. You didn't, I personally didn't realize that he'd been struck by Dijia until you slow it down and you realize, oh no. And then it's just, then at that point, you're just thinking, my goodness, he's lucky to be here. And I know, Rich, you wrote about this today for Autosport and talked about the reaction of Dijia. And I know for a fact he was visibly shaken up in the post-race debrief. And I mean, is he okay? How did he feel about it? Because I think he described it as the worst scene of his life when that had happened. Just obviously had to have been horrifying for him too.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the worst things that can happen. I mean, ask any train driver what it's like if someone jumps on the tracks in front of you. It's kind of up in that kind of sphere. These guys all know the risks, but of course, no rider wants that to happen. It's obviously super unlucky for everybody, also for Dija. And what really was surprising, maybe, and Dija highlighted it, was that Martin was attended to on the side of the track for such a long time by, I think it was two or three medical people or marshals. That's another thing that could have been a lot worse, because I saw the yellow flag was out for two laps and the broadcast didn't really show how long he was on the side of the circuit for. So guessing a little bit there, but that's a long yellow flag. And there is an argument for in a corner that fast with somebody pretty much on the curb at the edge of the track getting attention, you've got to do something more drastic than a yellow flag.
That was going to be my next question, funnily enough, was that given the prolonged medical treatment, given that that's a very fast complex of corners, and given that he was pretty close to the edge of the track, my first thought was, why has this not been stopped? Especially because it was long enough where the riders have come round again and they're entering that corner complex at full racing speed. And Martin is still being attended to by the medical team and obviously the marshals that are down there. This has come up before in MotoGP and in the junior classes and in obviously the senior class as well, where injured riders, if they're going to be injured for a significant amount of time on the ground, it seems, and I hope I'm not being too cynical when I say this, that race direction are reluctant to pull out the red flag. And is that a concern? Is that something where I think the sport needs to be a bit more prompt in doing something? I know you're limited with the information you've got in the heat of the moment, but is this something where the sport needs to be a bit more forthright with putting out a red flag? I mean, Yuri, you can go first on this one. You have a bit more experience in this than me, because this is a tough one, obviously.
Yeah, it's a very sensitive, and whatever we say can be misunderstood or misjudged. But I would say that is a very, very, very critical decision, and also is a very short period of time. What I would say, I come back to the previous topic that we were talking about. He was moving. He was conscious. And my main concern is that he was, as you say, so close to the edge of the track. That was my main concern, because otherwise we could have red flags every single Sunday. So it's very difficult to find the balance now, because we saw that he was hit by Didier, but at the same time, he was moving. I know that there are a lot of inputs that you need to process and you need to put together. But as Richard said, motorcycle racing is a dangerous thing. And you need to have that. It's very difficult to find the balance, and you won't have a straight and right answer, because I can say it this way, but you guys can say it, can see it opposite way, and it's fine. But would it happen anything if they pull out the red flag? No, nobody would have said, what have you done, marshals? At the same time, I think that they were monitoring the situation, and they considered, maybe in a wrong way, that in the end, they could have manage this situation with a yellow flag. I think, in my opinion, it's very on the limit. On the limit. I don't have any kind of, let's say, sympathy for race direction, because I think they can manage this many situations in a better way. But in this case, it's a difficult one to judge. I don't know how you see it.
I think probably just putting myself in the shoes of the marshals. I mean, of course, unfortunate, but Didja and Martin are there, they know the risks, etc. But if I were those medical staff or those marshals, I would be thinking, is my job worth running out to a place where I could be hit by the next crash at full speed? Those are not safe conditions to work under for anybody, especially one who has not chosen to actually ride the motorcycle. Yeah, I agree with Yuri. It's obviously very on the limit, very difficult. And I think it is quite rare that someone will be, luckily it's quite rare that someone will be so close to the edge of the track, kind of perfectly on the line, really, where the next accident could happen. Normally they're a bit further away, or somehow they've gone off the line. But this was about the worst kind of situation you could imagine in terms of treating somebody in a dangerous spot. So I think if there was a situation for a red flag for treatment, this was probably it.
Yeah. Look, I've said this on other podcasts I'm on in general, and as the way we talk about sports evolves, I don't envy anyone who's a sports official these days. It's a loveless, thankless job where you're expected to be perfect, and that just doesn't exist, quite frankly. And if you get it wrong, you will be vilified and destroyed from in the eyes of people who think they know better. And look, this was a very difficult situation. And I agree with Richard. If it was me, I'd be leaning towards a red flag in this instance. But as Yuri quite rightly says, I don't think anyone's criticizing race control if they pull a red flag out in that situation, especially now knowing what we know. you know, given how serious this was, because it didn't come across like that in real time until maybe the second lap round, where you realize, oh wait, Jorge's still there, and you know, this is clearly a bit more serious than your average broken bone, or you know, maybe a broken collarbone where you can walk away from that, or a broken wrist where you might be seen holding a hand, but you're able to get away under your own power. This clearly was not that. This was clearly a step above that. And again, where Martin was relative to the track was the big ironic red flag to me, at least as a fan. But yeah, I don't envy Mike Webb and the race control department on that one. I don't think there is a right decision you can take, because let's be real here, no one ever really wants to stop a race if they can help it, you know. But again, we can discuss that one at home, because that is a very difficult one. And I don't envy any sports official that has to make that kind of decision with limited information, in the heat of the moment, in real time, with not knowing all the information you could know that we now know 2-3 days later in hindsight. It's not an easy one. And I know it's very easy to get on social media and say, this should have been reds in capital letters, but it really just isn't as simple as that. And I will always try to give those sports officials the benefit of the doubt, because I would not want to be in that chair as that's happening, because that's a really, you know, a borderline one, as I think as Yuri quite rightly said, it's right on the line for me between, you know, calling that off and making sure that Jorge is obviously getting the utmost medical care.
It's quite funny because we have this final outcome that Jorge is at the hospital, will be for a while there at the hospital. We see that way. It could have been much worse, and then we would be destroying resurrection. But on the other hand, if nothing would have happened to him, we wouldn't probably be talking about that.
It's very true.
So
it's hindsight's a powerful thing, isn't it?
Exactly.
It's exactly. Hindsight's a very, very powerful thing. If that's a worse outcome, then we are obliterating race control for what happened. It's very much easy for us as podcasters, as journalists, to comment about it 2 days later, now knowing a lot more than they did in real time. And before I move on as well, from all of us here, best wishes to Jorge Martin, and we hope to see him on a bike again. I would say a speedy recovery, but no, please take your time, because that was horrendous. And thank goodness he's going to be relatively okay in the grand scheme of things.
And maybe just on a positive note, it's it was really nice to see him out in Aprilia colors. And until Sunday, it was a really positive weekend for him. And so he's got that to hang on to, I think, for whenever his comeback is. Obviously, this year is a write-off in terms of points. But he seemed to be, you know, his heart was absolutely in it. It seemed like a good fit, just watching from afar between him and Aprilia. And his pace was good, considering his injuries.
About a second and a half off. I mean, given first weekend back, you know, very little running on the Aprilia in general compared to his teammate Marco Bezzecchi, and of course the other track house riders that are on the Aprilias as well. Martin was not a million miles away from them at all, which is a very positive sign, all things considered, right, Yuri?
Yeah, he was super close to get into Q2. He was super close to get into Q2. I think his main issues were the position on the bike that he's still working on, and also his physical condition, but mainly on the upper right side of the body, because he was trying to compensate the weakness that he has on the left side. So he was completely destroyed on Friday. He was doing 2-3 laps and stopping. Saturday 10, and then Sunday his aim was to do 15 or trying to finish the race. My main concern is first his physical condition, and then how is he mentally going to be when he jumps on the bike again?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very good point. That is quite a traumatic incident, to say the least, and I hope it hasn't dented his confidence or anything along those lines.
The thing is that every time he jumps on the bike, he gets injured on that bike.
Yeah. So the third time already, which is just crazy.
So let's see.
Let's see, indeed. Yeah, again, all the best to Jorge, and we wish him I don't want to quite say speedy, given how severe this was, but, you know, I wish him a pleasant recovery. And we've already seen him on Instagram try to update himself, so he's active and clearly at least in decent spirit, which is great to see, and hope to see him back on a bike at 100%. In the future. I don't want to say near future at all. Take your time, Jorge. There is no one rushing for you to come back. And I mean that in the nicest way possible. Moving on a little bit here. And gentlemen, has there been a bigger surprise this year than so far this season than Maverick Viñales legitimately leading half this race on merit with Tech 3 KTM? Because KTM's been a bit of a sputtering midfielder this year. They've been hanging around the bottom end of the top 10. Pedro Acosta's tried, and nothing's really worked at KTM. Their financial difficulties have been well documented so far this year. But for Maverick Viñales to be second on the road and was leading about half this race on paper is incredible. I don't think anybody saw that coming. I don't think Maverick himself even saw this one coming. Incredible performance, Yuri.
Yeah, it was outstanding. I mean, I didn't see that coming. And I think, as you mentioned, never would have expected him to be that fast that soon. We remember that we had Maverick winning in Austin last year. So it's the Viñales things, you know, he normally does this kind of things. I really hope this time we're going to see him again, maybe not P2, but we can see him around top positions in Jerez. And from then on, he can build up, let's say, a strategy to get stick there. I still have some doubts about Maverick because he needs to convince me and most of the motorcycle racing fans, because unfortunately, or fortunately for him, these are the Maverick Viñales things that he out of the blue, he wins a race and he is showing an outstanding performance. Let's see. He's been working very, very good with Caso, with his race engineer, and KTM is super happy with him, with his way. He was super patient during the pre-season. I remember talking with some colleagues and say, whoa, no, learning. And I was asking him, okay, we know that you are patient, but are the KTM bosses patient as well? And he said, it's not my problem. I mean, I just need to learn. So, well, if he can keep going like this, it means that he is learning super fast.
And let's just hope that it's not like last year, where Maverick Viñales' performance early in the season turns out to be the very best one by a non-Ducati, because that would be a very depressing thought 4 rounds in.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, that was the one Grand Prix win we had last year that wasn't won by a Ducati. Ducati have won 21 in a row since then, and they have been perfect. Unfortunately, because of Maverick's post-race penalty, which we now know was a 16-second time penalty, you'll know the rules now. If he failed to meet tire pressure regulations, it's an automatic 16-second time penalty. It dropped Maverick down to 14th in the end, just a couple of points instead of what would have been 20 for second place. I mean, Rich, we've got to have another conversation about tyre pressures. And if you've heard me on this show, I don't like talking about this, but I've been left with no choice. It's almost like Maverick's been punished for leading a race for too long. And I think that's just preposterous that we're even having this conversation. And I know it's such a mess of tyre manufacturers teams taking the mickey with tire pressures in general before it was discovered and it went public a couple of years ago that teams had been, for lack of a better phrase, taking the piss. And the sport figuring out a way of trying to clamp this down has led to another situation where one of the biggest outlier results of the year all of a sudden now effectively doesn't count.
Luckily, we did get to enjoy the podium ceremony and seeing the non-Ducati up there at least before he was thrown out. But seriously, that it was a nice distraction from the usual, but it's not a good look for the sport. I'm not sure there is much new that you can say about it. I mean, you've made all the points there, and I think they're the same points that have happened in or been relevant in previous situations like this. But the most ridiculous, the two points I would say are that basically people are getting punished for doing better than they think, especially leading and not having other riders in front of them. Because they've just guessed wrong on that. I mean, the only person who can go into a race thinking I'm going to be leading with nobody in front of me is Marc Marquez. If it happens to anybody else, they could have a tire pressure problem. That's 21 out of 22 riders who are hoping to get lucky with this.
Can you imagine? Can you imagine Maverick saying to his race engineer, be careful with the tires because I think I'm going to be leading the race? I mean, it's not exactly.
It's ridiculous.
Okay. No worries. I got it. I think that this rule needs to be redefined because it's. What happened in Thailand with Mark? It's the clear example that it needs to be changed. I mean, you can set a rule at the beginning of the race. Okay, fair enough, but then. I mean, it's against the spirit of racing. So it needs to be revised.
I said it in my first episode on this podcast in Thailand that it's ridiculous that anyone in motorsport should ever feel like they have to give up the lead of a race intentionally or else they're going to get a time penalty. That goes against every racing bone in my body that's even a rule or something that a rider has to think about. I think that's preposterous. And I completely understand why Maverick didn't have that thought. And yeah, as Yuri quite rightly says, imagine Maverick telling his engineer, oh yeah, I'll be leading, don't worry about it. Like, watch the tires, knock them down like 0.2 of a PSI just in case. This rule needs to be looked at. You cannot punish riders for leading dominant lengths of races. I think that's completely ridiculous that we have to even have this conversation. Maybe make it so if you are leading a race because of the lack of dirty air behind you, maybe you get an exemption from that lap having to count against your allocation. Something crazy like that. If you lead a lap over the line, it doesn't count, or something like that, because I think it's stupid that we're having to have this conversation three or four times a year now that you're essentially being punished for being better than you thought or being too good at your job. It's ridiculous. And I feel sorry for Maverick because a brilliant performance has been ruined by a combination of the teams looking for every performance gain they can get. Dorna trying to figure out a way of stopping the bleeding essentially from this leak and embarrassment that, oh yeah, teams are basically running flat tires at the start of races to gain performance. And the fact that, again, Michelin, who are trying to solve this by having new tires, they're now going to be out of the sport in a year and a half's time. So how much of an effort are they going to make towards trying to fix the problem now, knowing that they're not going to be in MotoGP at the end of next year anyway? Like, this is going to be dead money if you're Michelin, because where's the return on your investment going to be when you're not going to be part of MotoGP in 2027? Now we know Pirelli's going to be coming in. So it's all just a political manufacturing mess that is going to be so difficult to untangle going forward that I have a bad feeling we're going to be talking about this again and again before this before we finally move on. Maybe Michelin gets to put a new front tire in that isn't so bad, or maybe the sport changes the parameters of this, but it's just ridiculous. I can't stand it. It angers me as a bike fan that we've got to have these conversations.
And of course, it's not just about race wins. It can affect anybody who's leading a group further down the field as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And having to have that conscious thought in the back of your head of, hang on, am I in too much open air? It's so silly. A couple of other points I wanted to mention before we get out of here. Another KTM point, Yuri. Pedro Acosta, speaking of KTM, kind of talked about reverting to the 2024 bike again and saying that there was an immediate better feeling on last year's KTM over this year's KTM. It's kind of a weird one now because Acosta's reverted spec, but Mavericks just had a Grand Prix where KTM finished 2 seconds off the win and was second on the road. It's like, what is going on at KTM here? Like, there seems to be like they're at a crossroad in terms of development.
Yeah, well, as you said, Acosta went back to the 2024 chassis and the seat and some other stuff, but he was immediately good the first time he went on track, but he had the same kind of vibrations the second time he went on track. So that's the main problem. They don't really understand where these vibrations come from. All of them have vibrations, don't get me wrong. It's nothing specifically from the KTM. In fact, Ducati has been working on a mass damper on the last part of the Ducati's bike. Mark was using it the whole weekend. DJI used it in the race, and it helps a bit. This kind of mass damper, it's only optional, or only the GP25 bikes can use it. The others are thinking on it. Pecco doesn't like it, but I mean, it says that vibrations, all the manufacturers have it these days. It's just a matter, possibly, again, about the Michelin new construction tire. So all of them have vibrations, but some manufacturers are dealing better than the others with it.
Yeah, the rear end chatter problems that have been a big problem amongst everybody in the sports as we develop more and more aerodynamics and more ground effect. And how the manufacturers are dealing with that is going to be a big influence on how everybody tries to extract performance. And yeah, it's going to be very weird seeing what KTM decides to do, because Acosta has gone back to last year's chassis, claimed he liked it briefly, didn't really, and now Mavericks showed them that, hang on, KTM maybe does have a bit of speed here for the first time all season. We'll have to wait and see on that one. Rich, I want to come to you on this one as well next up, because if there was one big winner of Maverick falling down the order due to that tire pressure penalty, Johann Zarco, P4 on a Honda. That's a sensational performance from the Frenchman, and there's got to be some hope out of that Honda camp that they might have figured something out here, because we had Zarco fighting with a GP24 with Franco Morbidelli out there right to the very end of this race, and Zarco, not for the first time this season, is mingling with podium runners.
It's happened really fast, hasn't it, that this is not even entirely a surprise because of what Zarco has already done so far this season, especially in Argentina, where he was really, really strong, and the way he talks about the bike so positively, even when he has had a bad day or a bad session, he's still smiling and saying, you know, this Honda's going in the right direction. So it wasn't even a surprise. We're four races in and we're talking about Honda's knocking on the doors of podiums. And that is one of the bright things about the situation at the moment, is that although Marquez is probably going to run away with this world championship for riders, there may be some hope for the other manufacturers to at least challenge the Ducatis that are not Mark. And I think Honda's probably leading the way on that. I think they've been the most consistent out of the others. I mean, everybody has had their chance. KTM probably made the biggest headlines now. They were the last one to really show any form, but then it was crazy good form. But as Yuri said, this is Maverick, so let's see if how much was the rider and how much was the bike. But if you look at the consistency among all the riders, of course, Chantra is still learning at the back. But Zarco and the two factory bikes, if you look at their performances across the first four races, I think Honda has the most to get excited about heading back to Europe now.
Just one thing about that. It's super fun because we have this situation where Yamaha apparently has made a step on some tracks more than the others. Honda definitely has made a step. KTM is, let's say, made another step. But in my opinion, it's just because Ducati got stuck for the first time in 3-4 years. I mean, they decided to get stuck with the base of GP24. Even with the engine, well, not the engine because they are two different specs, GP25 and GP24, but the difference we've seen with Alex Marquez, with Frankie, it's like this. The others have made a step, but it's because Ducati hasn't done it for the first time in, let's say, 3-4 years. That's the, in my opinion, the difference in between this year and the years before.
Yeah, to be a bit British about this, Chatty raised their floor, like the floor, like it's in the minimum performance of their bikes is what is shutting people out, because now that Maverick lost that podium finish, Ducati have still locked out every single podium, sprint and Grand Prix we've had this year. They've scored every available point they could have done in the Manufacturers Championship. And one of my friends on my Discord server actually pointed out, if the season stopped today, everybody except Ducati would be in tier D for concessions. Because I think Honda are now second in the manufacturers, I think on 49 points. That's 33% of Ducati's total, which would put them in tier D for concessions. So everybody except for Ducati would be in tier D, and Ducati obviously would be in tier A with a perfect start to their season, which... Sorry to bring the mood down a little bit, but I had to point out the polar opposites and then these situation that we're in where Ducati is just so good. And even Fermin Aldeguer, who was still learning as a rookie, is now starting to be in the top six more often now. He was in the top six in COTA before he crashed, and he was top six again here in Qatar. So any way in is going to be Zarco, maybe Fabio Quartararo, but Yamaha are struggling a little bit back there as well. I mean, just before we get out of here, Fabio Quartararo, first front row start since 2022. I was incredibly impressed with his qualifying lap to get on the front row. Still a huge admirer of that man's talent. But Yamaha just not there in race trim yet. And just every time we see Yamaha perform well in qualifying over a single lap, because you know Fabio is a brilliant qualifier, but in just it's got to be frustrating watching them slip back through the field, because they can't fight people with that bike at the moment, Yuri.
Yeah, but it's what he chose. I mean, to be in Yamaha, so there was no other inputs in a different situation. Now we are starting to see a reaction from Yamaha, but we all knew that this was not going to be night and day, from night to day, so super fast. So I think he's getting there, but and the good thing is that we've seen in Qatar a Fabio sharp again. So that's the best news, because if you are there fighting and your bike doesn't perform, maybe you start to give up a bit. So, but we've seen Fabio super sharp again, especially on qualifying and on the sprint. So yeah, let's hope Yamaha keep pushing and can give him and Alex Rins a better tools. Don't forget that they are testing on paper. They are testing the first, I wouldn't say first, but the first kind of spec of the B4 engine in Valencia today and tomorrow with Augusto and Cal Crutchlow after a year. He's back from his injury in the hand. So let's see what they say in Jerez about that.
Yeah, fingers crossed, because if there's one thing I saw from Fabio during the sprint in Qatar and at COTA in Austin a couple of weeks ago, it's not through lack of trying. He's throwing everything at that Yamaha. He's putting shapes on that thing to try and defend positions and fight bikes that we all know are just better than what the Yamaha is right now. So, again, I know Fabio kind of made this bed for himself and now he's got to try and figure this out. Maybe you could make an argument he's been a bit too loyal to Yamaha for his own good, but it's not through lack of trying. He's certainly giving it everything he's got with the tools he's got, even if they are limited. That'll just about do it for this edition of the Tank Slappers. I hope you guys enjoyed the show. We'll be back in a week and a half's time after the Spanish Grand Prix at Jerez. We're not crossing fingers that Pecco Bagnaia is a bit more competitive next week, but we're not doing that either. I'm just saying. So we'll see if Marc Marquez can make it 4 wins out of 5 on the year and if anyone can challenge him in his own backyard at Jerez. Until then, I've been Dre Harrison, Dave Vinieri, Richard Asher. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next time. Take care.